You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
This is David Rovics and you are tuned to 3CR, 8:55 a.m., Melbourne, Australia. Step three is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do, and everything can change.
Hello and welcome to the Climate Action Show on the Community Broadcast Network. I would like to acknowledge and pay respect to the people of the Woorong and Boomerang language groups of the Eastern Kulin Nations on whose unceded lands the 3CR studios stand, respectfully acknowledging their ancestors and elders, past and present. We also acknowledge the traditional custodians and the ancestors of the lands and waters across Australia where our broadcast reaches. Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of the Climate Action Show. My name is Shay and I'm your host for today. Today's show features a conversation I had with Anthea Lawson. Anthea is an author and a campaigner. After training as a journalist at The Times, she worked for campaign groups including Global Witness and Amnesty International. She has fought for many issues over three decades, including controls on the arms trade and an end to the financial secrecy offered by tax havens. She's the author of two books, The Entangled Activist and How Not to Save the World. Both help people who want to change the world think about the psychological, spiritual, and philosophical foundations of what they're doing, what's getting in the way, and how they can be more effective. So initially I was drawn to the title of Anthea's book, How Not to Save the World, which looks at the saviorism complex within activism. And her writing, I think, well, her standpoint, it sort of addresses very much activism in a UK context, but which I think has a lot of parallels in an Australian context as well. But it is also quite concerned, not entirely, but it interrogates mostly middle-class forms of activism. And I think climate activism, in some ways, the way that sort of we know it or in the way that we have seen it in the present, not in its entirety, but in a lot of ways has been dominated or sort of heavily influenced by the middle class. And definitely environmental activism and care is not at all exclusive to middle class white Western cultures. It knows no boundaries or limitations in that sense. I think caring about nature and the environment is and has been something that's transgressed any kind of class or race or cultural boundaries. But I do feel like, yeah, climate activism has in a lot of ways been taken on board or really projected by the middle class quite heavily in the sense of protesting and striking and blockades and certain groups and movements. And yeah, I think in this way, the fight against climate change has been oriented towards middle class standpoints in the same way that sort of environmental and sustainable choices such as buying an electric car or shopping at, you know, like a refillable organic grocery shop is tailored towards those with the privilege and the means and the money to make those kind of choices. So yeah, I guess what I'm trying to say is that, well, environmental activism and care isn't solely something that the middle class cares about. It is something that has been projected, for lack of a better word, by, yeah, the middle class in how it presents itself today. So this conversation with Anthea, it very much addresses this kind of specific middle-class climate activism that we see a lot of, and one of those problems in that is this kind of saviorism complex and also this viewpoint that we are, I guess, separate from the issue and it's up to us to sort of make the change the world needs in this regard, and the big oil companies and the billionaires are the ones that are causing the problem, and while that's very much true, we also kind of see ourselves as removed from it and that we are changing it from the outside. But I think in all honesty, we're very much entangled with the issue and more needs to happen in the area of changing how we think and how we hold relationships rather than just changing policy and presenting the facts and hoping that others will come on board. So I've gone off on a bit of a tangent, but this is where Anthea comes in. Her books really address this distinct type of activism and interrogate that saviorism and the removal from the problem, which is what sometimes climate activists find themselves doing. So yeah, I just wanted to set this context before we get into the interview. But without further ado, let's get into it. How did you get to where you are now? If you could take me through your journey of activism right up until writing this book.
Right, okay. So I'm not massively young anymore, so I'll try and be concise. So I thought I was going to save the world by being a journalist. I trained as a news reporter in my early 20s and worked as a news reporter for a while. And in my spare time, I was involved in various kinds of activist-y, change-making type stuff because that's what I was drawn to. So I was spending any time when I was not at work on a permaculture project in Spain, planting trees and practicing off-grid self-sufficiency and learning about those kinds. I didn't grow up in, you know, I grew up in a, you know, small C conservative voting a household of, you know, small business owners. That's where I came from, like middle class. And yeah, so that was all quite eye-opening for me, kind of, you know, doing sustainability and vegan food and all of that. This is mid-90s. And then by the late 90s, I was going out on anti-globalization protests. So this was a global movement that started in the global south, but was spreading to the global north by the mid-90s, of protesting against the outsized influence of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, you know, which are proxies for the rich country governments, basically. Mm-hmm. And their models that they were imposing, you know, because of the debt burdens that poor countries were in. And they were imposing what was called structural adjustment programs, which basically means, like, we're going to choose what your economy does. The usual neoliberal model of privatization and deregulation and opening up markets to multinationals, which was leaving people much worse off and catastrophic for the environment. So there were all those protests going on. And then I was going into my work at the Times, a Rupert Murdoch newspaper. And I think at some point the dissonance of it just shut me down. I experienced what at the time, well, it felt like some kind of chronic fatigue illness. And it was, I mean, I'm not saying it wasn't physical, but there was some other, I mean, I was burnt out, but there was some other, because I'd been doing a crazy work schedule, but goodness me, it wasn't just that. I think some bit of me shut me down because I couldn't allow myself to resign from this job because I thought, oh, well, I've got this great job. But actually, I was having to shut down 80% of my brain in order to walk in through the door in the morning. I'd ended up as a business news reporter and I was reporting on company news, and the way that company news is structured is, oh, well, this share price has gone up, you know, and that's a positive thing. And I'd be like, well, why has it gone up? You know, who's been laid off? You know, what forest is about to be cut down? Mm. So when I recovered, I took my journalism skills and I went to work for human rights organisations. I worked on arms trade campaigning for about 5 years. I worked on the cluster munitions ban with a landmine anti-landmine organisation. I worked for the arms trade treaty, which was signed in 2013, eventually, long after I'd stopped working on it. So this is early 2000s by now. I worked for Amnesty International. I tried being an aid worker in Sierra Leone, which was I loved being there. I realised that aid work itself was whack, because what I saw was the extent to which the economy of that country was trash because of the mining companies. The money was going back to the City of London. This was around the time that, you know, that Blood Diamond film got made. Mm-hmm. There'd been a civil war there that was funded by the diamonds. The natural resource extraction, which was, you know, the profits were going to Western companies, was at the root of it. And I thought, well, it's you know, I'm sure, you know, I'm not saying there's no place for humanitarian support, but really I wanted to work on the structures. So I then worked for a long time for an organisation called Global Witness, doing investigations and campaigns into the nexus, the links between natural resource extraction, environmental destruction and human rights abuses. And there were plenty of links. I was looking at the role of the financial sector and tax havens. Around 2015, I stopped doing that full time. Not because it wasn't working. We were actually we were getting some laws changed at times. I worked on a campaign that we managed to get laws changed in dozens of countries requiring transparency over the real ownership of companies, which sort of shines a light and reduces the possibilities of corruption and tax evasion that create poverty. I was starting to have questions, and the questions were partly about why we were replicating so many aspects of what we were trying to change in our ways of doing it. And some of that was like strategy. Some of it was, so for example, here we are assuming a rational actor model, which comes from the form of economics whose effects we're trying to mitigate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this idea that we are homo economicus, you know, this idea that we simply want to maximize our financial potential and maximize our profit. You know, that's the idea that motivates kind of capitalist economies. And of course, we're more than that, right? We're relational beings, we're cooperative beings, we're community beings, and all of that can get trashed if you give too much power to markets. So here we were trying to mitigate the effects of markets that are doing that, but using the same rational actor model. Mm-hmm. We were assuming that by putting facts in front of people, they would act on them. So I wanted to question that. I was questioning some of the stuff that goes on, which perhaps is best simplified as human rights defenders treating each other terribly. Like what was going on there? This was just before there were a series of scandals in the UK charity sector, in the voluntary sector, around the time of Me Too and Black Lives Matter, which obviously unearthed these and gave people the power to speak about what had probably been going on anyway. Mm. But you know, this is going on in human rights organisations. Like what's that about? That was part of it. Another sort of mirror of what we were doing in the world was, here we are trying to stop an endless growth economy burning out the planet, and here we are burning ourselves out working in the same ways, you know, capitalist kind of sense of scarcity, running, never stopping. So I wanted to like start looking into that. I had a sense that we're not looking into our inner commitments. We can call it psychology, you can call it spirituality, you can call it your kind of underlying philosophy, you can call it mindsets if you're allergic to all of that, you can call it stories and narratives from the culture that affect how we, our assumptions and how we think. I wanted to look at all of the stuff that we don't, that we disavow, that we're unconscious of in our daily practice, and that can undermine our stated intentions and values. So I ended up writing a book called The Entangled Activist, which looked at some of that. That came out in 2021. And that, you know, that landed well with people who self-identify as activists.
Mm-hmm.
And it was harder to grasp for people who don't, because that word activist is so polarizing. Mm-hmm. A few people, a small proportion of any population, see themselves as activists, and the rest don't. And it really doesn't help that we, you know, have a mainstream and a mainstream media, a mainstream corporate media particularly, and certainly from the populist and hard right, this message that, you know, the activists are annoying, you know, that the backlash against net zero and climate campaigning, you know, by fossil fuel interests has focused on this, you know, always polarizing figure of the activist.
Mm.
Anyway, so in the book I've just written, I wanted to get away from talking about activism in inverted commas. Of course it's in there, but I wanted to frame it much more widely. So it's called How Not to Save the World. And the subtitle is Doing Good Without Annoying Everyone. That doesn't say anyone, we might annoy some people. And I wanted to question really this kind of save the world script that I think animates a lot of change making. And by change making, I'm casting that really broadly. It's like stuff we do in our communities. It might be climate movements. It goes on in the voluntary sector and charities. I think it goes on in philanthropy. I think it goes on the left. I realised once I'd finished writing the book, I think it goes on in aspects of the right as well. I think a lot of the things in this script, lots of us are doing, but there are some bits of it that are particular to progressive activism. And I wanted also to get really granular and practical about what the antidotes are. Because this stuff is not new. This script is ancient. It's really old. This stuff comes up generation after generation. And because we're in a kind of materialist culture that focuses on, you know, what's material and what's going on visibly, tangibly, much more than what's going on in our psyches, every generation, I think, has to restate this and look at it again.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really wanted to try and catch some of the wisdom that's out there. So I've interviewed a lot of people. I interviewed about 100 people for the first book. I've interviewed more than 100 for this one, all of them change makers of some kind, to try and distill some of the wisdom that people who've been in it a long time have got about antidotes to this kind of like prevalent must save the world idea that gets us into such a pickle. And so in How Not to Save the World, that's what I wanted to show.
Did you find that most of them were or had recognised a saviourism in themselves, or that maybe they hadn't?
Yeah, not everyone I spoke to recognises it, but all of those whose stories I was sharing and drawing on for like this sort of antidotes, then yes, although not all of them would put it like that. Not everyone sees it as saviorism. That word is quite particular, and it's really helpful in some contexts and not in others, because there are a whole load of things that, you know, if I'm dealing with concepts, I'd be like, oh yes, well, thinking that you know better, that's one of the things I'm saying is on the script, you know, is part of saviorism. But most people don't see it like that. They just see people thinking they know better. So, you know, like, how you define it doesn't really matter, but it's about what's going on. But it would also be true to say, so I'm perhaps I should say what the script is, right? And then like before I go, because I'm sort of referring to it. So I'm suggesting there are 7 things, and there's a chapter in the book about each of them. So this is an unconscious script that we're holding as change makers. We might not think this literally. So 1, I am good. 2, I protest. Now, that's not saying we shouldn't be protesting. We need to protest. When there's terrible stuff going on, we have to protest it. But this is about bringing our protest voice into every interaction at the dinner table with our colleagues, with our neighbours. Is that how we build movements horizontally? You know, making people think that we know better than them? Not really. 3, I'm pure. So this is about, you know, this tendency to kind of get really rigid about how we're going to do it, who we're going to do it with. Who can be involved, which is not helpful. So I wanted to look at where that comes from. 4 is I know better than you. There's lots to say about all of these. I'll just go through it quickly. 5 is I save people. 6 is I'm a hero. And 7 is I must save the world now, which is the urgency.
Urgency, yeah.
Yeah, you know, particularly with respect to climate and the ecological crisis, but and other things too. You know, it depends where you're situated in society as to what feels urgent to you and what's going on. If you're not able to get to the end of the week and get enough food on the table, that's the urgency, right? If you're suffering racist violence, that's the urgency. So, you know, that depends. But back to your point about did people see it, who I was talking to, it's funny because like all of these things are in all of us, right? So I felt all of it when I was writing the book. The very process of writing, I was constantly up against, oh God, I'm doing that thing again. Let me try and stop doing that. And people who, I've had funny reactions from people talking about it, who are like, oh yeah, I really see that in myself. But they're resistant to other things. So when I've been doing talks about it, I've got a bunch of placards with each of these that I've been holding up. And there are some that people don't like admitting to. Like when I held up the I'm pure one, people tend not to put their hands up.
Can you walk me through some of the antidotes that you found from your interviews? Yeah.
So that's the positive stuff, isn't it? Yes. So let me give you, I mean, I could go through them. I think I'd rather tell a story actually, that like gives a specific one. So let's look at I protest. Right. So, as I said, this is about, you know, we want to keep protesting. I don't know what's going on with protest rights in Australia. In the UK, we're having a nightmare with protest rights.
It's a nightmare as well. Yeah.
It's the same. Yeah. There's been some really horrible court cases recently, like just in the last week, relating to Palestine Action, a group that's been proscribed as a terrorist organisation. So now, you know, 3,000 elderly people, including the vicar of my parish, who sat on the grass and held up a sign, will be prosecuted for terrorism. Anyway, so this is not about not protesting. This is about how we use our protest voice. So I met someone who is not an activist, not a campaigner, She's an academic, and but she had the most brilliant story. She was working on a project relating to so the national, you know, the National Trust is like a heritage organisation here that kind of like holds in trust for the nation lots of historical houses and nice gardens and properties and whatnot. A lot of those, not a lot, a number of those houses are entangled in histories of enslavement in the Caribbean, and the profits that built them or that furnished them were coming from plantations in the Caribbean. So this woman was doing a project for the National Trust. You know, she's an academic. She was brought in to do this project about the these links. You know, it's a lovely project. School kids were involved, local communities were involved. A group of conservative members of parliament, calling themselves the Common Sense Group, I'm putting that in air quotes, started, you know, like causing culture war trouble about this. And the right-wing newspapers started writing about it. And every time there was an article about her, she got about 300 pieces of sometimes violent hate mail. And she chose to write back to some, not all of them, it was too much. But each time it happened, she wrote back to a few of them. Just very sort of straight, just saying, I received your email. The newspaper didn't give me a right to reply. I thought you might be interested to hear my perspective. And she explained just a bit about, you know, why she was doing the work and why she thought it mattered, you know, for all of us in Britain. And what is so striking about this is that within three back and forths or less, most people had returned to civility and, in fact, admiration to her for writing back. And I was really, really struck by this because so often when we are on our high horse about being right about something, it is so incredibly easy to dismiss people on the other side. Now, I did that for a long time in the work I was doing, you know, working for professional campaign groups where I was up against, you know, like corporate power. You know, it's one thing to kind of turn them into an enemy, and it's still, there's a separate discussion of still is that useful or not? You know, does it matter if I'm demonising the water company bosses who are making millions in bonuses while they're pouring shit into our rivers? Our antiquated sewage system here in the UK, you know, question mark. But this is about how do we talk to people that we encounter, where there's an opportunity to connect and maybe share our point of view. But what are we doing when we close that off completely by completely shutting down the possibility? So I was really struck by that. So in that particular example, sorry, what's that particular bit of the script, you know, I protest. It's about making space for connection. It's about listening as much as speaking. So with purity, the antidote is this sense of bridging. And there are organizations specifically set up to kind of talk about how we do this. So there's two bits of work here. One is to like look at the sources of needing to be pure in ourself, as I was talking about before, you know, like how psychologically, like how much of this is coming from our own insecurities? How much are we building a fortress to defend against our own insecurities by, you know, having to be pure, having to be right? It's the same antidote in terms of personal examination for several of these. But also, can we build a bridge? And so I interviewed people who are finding various ways of building bridges. They might be doing so through setting up groups that, you know, so I interviewed one bunch of people who are deliberately trying to do climate work that doesn't appeal to activists. So like this is a non-activist climate network. Or there are people sort of trying to bring racial justice and economic and climate justice together. So that's like across issues. So sometimes it's across issues, sometimes it's across people, but finding ways to bridge. And then there are the groups having conversations like the one I'm involved in. I'm involved in a thing called Common, it's on Instagram at Common Ground Conversations UK, where we set up just on the high street, you know, in pedestrianised shopping areas with a really lo-fi flip chart, bunch of questions about, you know, political policies, and stickers and column for yes, no, and question mark. And we just say to people, do you want to come and have a chat about politics? You know, I couldn't be doing that kind of bridging if I was in any of the mindset I used to be in. So what's quite interesting is I Well, there's two levels of why it's interesting. Right. So the interesting thing about this is that the antidotes to every single one of these had something in common, and they were all about relationship. But it's interesting doubly that that wasn't instinctive to me, and that it took me doing this research and writing this up to see that that pattern. Now, to people coming from a different position to me, from a lot of communities and a lot of places in the world, that would be completely self-evident. So in some ways, it's a measure of disconnection. How much of that is British? Some. How much of that is class? Some. Working class modes of activism are a lot more based on relationship, kind of instinctively. And that because it just sort of starts in community or in workplaces. I think there's something about middle class ways of coming into activism that are, because it's based on like a personal revelation, you might not have the lived experience, but you undergo some change of mindset, which is, oh, I'm not standing for this. Like you realise how the world is run and you want to do something about it. But it feels like a kind of ideological conversion. And so the underlying framework for thinking about it is, okay, now I'm an individual. Now I need to find other people who think like me. That's where some of that purity stuff can come in. It's like, well, if I'm going to do good stuff on this, I've got to be with the people who think like me. Whereas if you start in community, like we are all affected by something, you know, look what's happening with climate and ecological breakdown. That's what's coming. If we're going to be building the kind of resilience that we all need, it's going to have to be in communities. It's going to have to be with people who are not all going to be the same as us. Then we can't start from that. Oh, I've got the right idea. You know, these guys haven't. We've got to start with the relation.
Yeah.
So that relationality thing was at the heart of this.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
I want to ask about the sense of urgency, because this reminded me a little bit of the Dark Mountain Project manifesto, the uncivilization, and it, I kind of, as you were saying, drew the thread with the narrative of progress. And you say as well that like this book can act as a resource at a time of political disruption, because it's when we're most likely, people are feeling frantic, and it's when we're most likely to pick up this script. In climate activism, there is so much of a sense of urgency of trying to, you know, we have to act now and we have to, you know, time is running out. I drew that connection with the sense of progress, of how humans are kind of always trying to progress to the next step almost of being human, or to try and build a better world that is better than the one our parents or our ancestors had. And it's kind of going along this line of constant movement and constant growth almost. And I think it is quite a Western concept as well, in that kind of the narrative of progress. But did you also kind of draw this parallel with the sense of urgency? And do you touch on progress at all in your book, and how that kind of takes shape in climate activism?
Yes, I did. That's exactly the link I wanted to draw. Worth saying then a bit about what Dark Mountain is about, because there's been an interesting polarization in climate circles. The Dark Mountain Manifesto, I think, was written in 2009 or 10, and I remember it really hit me. And it was basically a couple of recovering environmentalists basically saying, you know, what if progress doesn't work? What if we look into the abyss and say we're not going to fix this? And you know, they famously had a great big sort of like to do at one of their first in-person gatherings with George Monbiot, who's a big, you know, climate and environmental journalist here. You know, and he was really rejecting it, you know. And a lot of people, I think because people really, you know, like to be on one side or the other of things, when it sounds like someone is saying this is not possible, I'm stopping, it sounds like you're saying I'm not gonna try anymore. And in the case of the founders, they were stepping away from that, and they've done some really deep thinking about it. The Dark Mountain Manifesto had a big effect on me. at first kind of it was it wasn't the cause of it, but I suppose it was a catalyst for me falling into a bit of a hole with my own activism of where am I going. But really that was related to the questions that I was talking about earlier that I already had about what I was doing. Actually, in the last 10 years, I would say, certainly since I got involved with Extinction Rebellion in 2019, I think it's that way of thinking is quite compatible with taking part in climate activism. And there are a number of Dark Mountain subscribers are involved in climate activism. Because for me, what it's doing, this question of like, what if we can't save things in their current form, is actually, I find it actually rather liberating. Because, you know, let's come back to this idea of saving. Like, what are we trying to do? Are we trying to preserve a way of life that worked for a small proportion of the world's population, i.e. the white upper middle classes, for the few generations before they realised the truth about climate change and an ecological breakdown, right? Is that what we're trying to do? That's not what I want to do. And that's not what most people want to do. So this idea of saving as a form of fixing is where I think there's a kind of correspondence between what Dark Mountain, you know, the entire sort of project is questioning and suggesting, and where I'm going with how we can think more generatively about activism. What I've come to in myself is that I don't want to step away. I'm not going to sit on the sofa while the far right tries to get control of my country and threatens communities and neighbours and anyone, really. Like, I'm going to resist that. I'm not going to not try and make things better. I'm not going to not try and steer things in the direction I'd like them to be in as much as I can. But I acknowledge now that what I'm doing is not trying to save the world and I'm not trying to fix it. I am trying to make things as best they can be, or as least shit they can be when we're in like serious defense mode at any given time. And I'm happy for that to be the purpose of my life. You know, obviously I have to, you know, I'm doing other things as well. I'm raising kids and I pay the bills and I contribute to community, but that's, you know, the contribution to community, that's all part of it, basically. And coming to that realization, which has been really slow and painful and has involved me falling in some really deep psychic holes on a couple of occasions, I can say it very easily, and it sounds kind of glib now to be able to say it that easily, and it's not been, and yet at the same time I'm conscious that for a lot of people to hear somebody saying that is absolutely preposterous. Like, what, you actually thought you could fix something? You know, like the colonized have been living in the wake of capitalism and empire for 500 years. Anyone dealing with racialization in this sort of mad ideology of race that structures our societies, like, knows that this, you know, tragically is not going to be fixed in a generation. This is multi-generational work. And so.
But it plays into that individualism. Sorry. Because of that it's up to you, and but that's exactly what the problem is the individualism, and not so much the, because so many other cultures would say you're never going to see that kind of change that you're probably striving for within your lifetime anyway, but wouldn't it be more important to kind of build a lot more community around that? And I think as well, when you're just speaking, that made me think of, in climate activism, I feel like there's kind of this hurdle that we see ourselves in front of, and that if we can just sort of get over it and fix the problem of climate change, then all will be well. But we don't even know what kind of future we want on the other side of that hurdle, or what that could possibly look like. And it's not going to be a very good future if we're not first interrogating the way we form relationships on this side of the kind of hurdle. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah. Well, you're bringing in the question there about means and ends.
It's a means to an end. Yeah, exactly.
This was a really big part of this, you know, because there's a whole tradition on the left of like, well, you know, you just get power And then you, you know, and then you do what you can with it. And then there's another whole tradition on the left, you know, the anarchist one, basically, which says, no, it's how we do it that matters. You know, and if you're just, if you're going to, you know, cause violence and harm and oppress people on your way to power, then that's not the future we want. So, the, you know, these are really, really, really long discussions with long, long, long traditions. And I think to come back, I'm conscious that I haven't answered your question about urgency properly, because I sort of went slightly off on that, the link with the Dark Mountain, oh, we can't save it thing. So this comes back to it a bit, really.
Well, the urgency question was about whether or not you found those kind of parallels with the notion of progress and the urgency within activism. I think what I was curious about was the fact that, like you said, when things get really, when political disruption is really sort of charged and happening quite consistently in a lot of places, people get frantic, and that is when they're likely to pick up the script. And actually, I guess what another question I wanted to ask was, which kind of relates, and you talk a little bit about social media, opening everything up, and how people can now see all the various parts of activism, which has equally opened it up to a lot of criticism. But I think, would you think maybe that because of that, activists have had to sort of double down on defending their script in their actions? Because with social media and with so much kind of political disruption, that save the world script seems to be something that we kind of just attach to as a last resort, because this urgency comes back to us.
I think you're right, and I think what I want to think about here is how urgency isn't just an idea. It's something that runs in our bodies. It hijacks our nervous system, and it puts us into like a fight flight mode, basically, which is a more kind of a heightened state in which our thinking capacity, our like cognitive processing capacity, is somewhat reduced. And so this is I think this is what you're pointing to, and I think I'm saying the same thing, which is that the unthinkingness of this script, including some of the things that we do, you know, when we're feeling urgent and panicky, kind of kicks in that situation. Now, I think lots of things have caused that. Social media absolutely does it. Social media, you know, this is not we. I did not invent a machine that harnesses our human nervous system responses and weaponizes them into a giant machine of global dysregulation that can then be used to spread support for the far right, because that's how the far right works, right? They go on fear. And so they've won the internet in this first iteration, this first generation. You know, we're in an epochal revolution here, and now, you know, the next stage of it, AI, is underway. So yeah, they've created this thing that, you know, hijacks us. So yes, that's part of what's happening. And I think it's no coincidence that the culture wars, in the form that they took in the 2010s, emerged at that point, because social media sort of was enabled it. You know, the technical term is it's an affordance. It kind of allowed that to happen. Also, the script predates social media. It's really, you know, it's really old. It's generations old. I've been tracking manifestations of it in different political movements, like through separate to this book, I've been tracking it, you know, different political movements through the 20th century. And I think it goes back before that as well. What social media does, though, is it kind of weaponizes it, and it sort of supercharges it. You're right. We go into it without thinking. And then what we've got with the rise of far-right ideologies, presence on the street, reinforcement and appeasement of it in the mainstream media and by so-called mainstream political parties, you know, that have actually gone far to the right of where they used to be. that's doing it as well, because they're operating on a fear basis. And I can feel it happening in myself. So for all of these reasons, we can find ourselves jumping into the script. And so and therefore, for all of these reasons, it's really worth staying as conscious as we can of what's going on, so that we can try and bring the antidotes in where we can, mm-hmm. of staying in relation, whoever it is that we're trying to talk to. Now, are there limits to that? You know, one of my friends who lives in a town there where there was a big far right and then anti-fascist standoff last weekend, he sent me a message at the weekend going, oh, I'm just reading your book, you know, so you're suggesting we have conversations with these guys. It's like, no, actually, you know, when there are fascists in the streets, you've actually just got to show up.
Yeah. Rebecca Solnit wrote an essay on that, why I'm not talking, or can't remember what it was, talking to fascists, yeah, or something.
I've not seen that one. She's very wise, and I'm sure lots of things that I'm pointing to she's found ways of saying as well, because she, you know, all of this just comes around and needs saying. Yeah, there are points when you can't talk, but there are also points when you can, and so, you know, it's about the context. But some of it is about, you know, it's not that all the antidotes to the script are pointing towards, you know, talking to those that we might want to dismiss. That's just part of it. Sometimes it's about how we comport ourselves in ways that we maximise the chances of building broader support, building broader coalitions for what it is that we want to promote and build.
I imagine there would also be some aspect of interrogating our own kind of quickness to judge, or to, like you call it, to create an over-there-ness with the other side. But I think it's also to do with how complex everything is as well. And I think, like, social media amplifies this, but there is so much complexity in the world, and we're exposed to a lot more, but there's also the systems seem to be quite a lot more complex than what they kind of once were. And so we're kind of met with this overabundance of things to process. And I think that can actually have an effect, like a sense of urgency on our nervous system as well, where we either shut down or we just kind of pick up the comfortable narratives within ourselves that make it easier of, oh, well, they're just wrong and they're, you know, they don't understand and I can't be bothered dealing with them. So I think that plays into it a little bit as well, with, I guess, how activism can become quite quickly polarizing and you know, splits into factions. But let's just leave behind the sense of urgency and the progress, because I actually think interrogating this progress narrative is worth an entire other hour dedicated to it. But I wanted to ask a little bit about the life worlds and the imaginary that you talk about. And I have a question, but I think maybe best just for you to sort of describe a little bit and put into context what these life worlds and this imaginary is in the context of activism.
Yeah, so I was looking at this in The Entangled Activist, my first book, which I was getting a bit theoretical here, because I was I was seeking ways to understand, like, why is it that we're replicating aspects of the problems that we want to change in our ways of changing them. And so what I was seeking ways of understanding was the ways in which we are influenced by the environment that we're in. That's what it comes down to. And these are just two different theoretical terms, basically, from sociology, about that offer a way of thinking about us not really as individuals who are separate from what we're in. So we are influenced in profound kind of constitutive ways, which means, like, we are made up of the influences that come to us. Yes, of course, you know, we bring our genetic heritage that we come in with. But, you know, even that's really complicated now, because we know about epigenetics and the way that certain ways that genes can express themselves are affected by the experiences that our parents and even grandparents can have. You know, they've tracked this through Holocaust survivors. So even in that way that, you know, that we thought was like an immutable bit of like who we are, we're utterly permeable, basically, and we influence each other in different ways. And so where this pertains to activism is because I think when we, you know, and this comes down to like on the script of in How Not to Save the World of like, I'm good. It's like, you know, we're good and that system's bad. And so so we're separate from it and we're going to like, and because we're separate, we're going to, you know, this then brings in all sorts of questions about cause and effect. We think we can kind of like push it from the outside. That's not how it works. You know, as you were saying, you know, like we're in complex systems. But really what I wanted to point out was we're not separate from it, basically. Mm-hmm. We're, you know, the cliche is this is the... you know, that we're the fish that can't see the water that it's swimming in. And so when we try to create this idea that we're somehow separate, thus better than everyone else, we create a situation where we reinforce that. There's some really interesting research been going on in the UK from a group called More in Common, and they found, I have got some issues with some of their framing, but anyway, they've done some great research like looking at the progressive activist segment of the population and the way that they see everything so very differently, and they're not looking at this is based on polling data, they're not looking at the kind of what's going on underneath, that they're not looking at the kind of psychodynamics of the unconscious stuff that we often don't want to think about, but they are noting the way that progressives consistently, systematically and massively overestimate the extent to which the rest of the population agrees with them. Now, it's funny, this, isn't it? Because like we've got these two different things going on. So one thing is we think we're really, really separate from everyone else. We think we're not shaped by, you know, the structures of thought and feeling that everyone else is in. We think, oh, yeah, we're better. And yet at the same time, possibly that's it seems contradictory that, you know, we'd be like overestimating the way they're, you know, thinking everyone else agrees with us. See, I think it comes from the same thing. There's a sort of absorption. It's like we're so in our world of like, well, we're right, that we forget that people do see things differently. You know, there's always a real range of views in what's going on, and the extent to which other people's views are being also relentlessly shaped by what's going on in the mainstream media, what's going on social media, and the enormous effort that's coming in from the hard right and further right to shape that. So that's all of this is going on at the same time, basically.
It's also quite ironic, really, because when you talk about this kind of abstracted, I guess, position that a lot of activists take in seeing themselves as away from the problem but able to shape it, it reminds me a lot of the nature culture dualism.
That's it. You know, we must change that. Leave out saving the world. I mean, I did want to write about like the saving mentality, but just changing the world. The very language of that is subject object. I'm going to change the world. You know, which is why I really love that line from Parable of the Sower, the dystopian novel written by Octavia Butler in the early 90s, set in 2024 in California. You know, and it's not, there was quite a lot of comment when the date went past about how much of it had already come true. Everything you touch, you change. Mm-hmm. Everything you change changes you. I haven't got that exactly right, but it's something like that. You know, that's a really powerful evocation of that entanglement between us and everything else, and not having this what's the word I'm after? Exceptionalism. That's the word I'm after. So in How Not to Save the World, I'm looking at two types of exceptionalism. Like there's the very British sense of exceptionalism, which I think comes from class and empire, which leads to particular forms of saviour complex, particularly amongst the middle classes, though not exclusively. And then there's that exceptionalism of that we were just talking about, of the activist position, which is... Yeah, I think I'm not affected by this stuff. It's not part of me. And then ironically, I'm going to go from that point to assume that everyone else thinks like me, and then dismissing them when they don't, rather than, you know, I'm not saying we can persuade everyone. I don't really think the job is persuading, actually. I think there's limits to persuasion. But there are many opportunities still going unexplored. There's so much more we could do to build resilience against climate breakdown and resilience against the far right in our communities. And this is open to everyone. You don't need to be a quotes activist to do this. You need to start talking to your neighbours and knocking on doors. I've come across several projects. There are lots of them in the UK. I keep, you know, because I'm now following all the right things on social media and I see them, but it's really hard to see them if you're not looking for them. Mm. So it's easy to get despondent. But there's so much good stuff going on that all starts with people getting together with a few people in their community and going and knocking on everyone's door and saying, what do you love about this place? What's troubling you about this place? What should we do together to try and improve things? And amazing stuff is happening.
That kind of, quite nicely leads to my next question. I heard you speak about that there was a lot of research done with how protest has the biggest cause on those who take part as opposed to those who witness it. Mm. Yeah, could you touch a little bit on that and how that could influence activism or how activism manifests a bit differently if we're aware of that?
Well, I mean, it's simply in understanding that people aren't influenced by what they hear or what they're told. They're influenced by what they do. So actually the task, you know, this comes back to this point about how we come into activism. If we've had a personal revelation that, you know, the way the world is run is whack and we need to do something about it, you know, and having that as an idea is very different to kind of having an experience that you share with other people and then coming together and let's do something about it. So the way to invite people in is to not try and persuade them. If you're hoping to get people to sign up for activism, or sign up for whatever it is you're doing, by persuading them of it, you're less likely to succeed than if you can get together and do something first. And so the thing that you do might be something quite unpolitical. You know, it might involve providing food. It might involve getting together in community for something. And then you take people from there into doing more together. And it is the taking part and being amongst people doing that that, you know, the research on protest movements seems to show is what influences people more. Because once, you know, I can see this in my own trajectory. See, look at that story I told at the beginning. It was me going on those anti-globalisation marches that created the dissonance with my job. And I was like, well, I can't carry on doing that. So, you know, okay, it's true that I had the privilege to be able to switch to a different kind of job. Not everyone has that opportunity, but this can work in different ways. The point is, it's the participation and the being with people, doing something with people in relation with them, that is most likely to change people's minds. There's a really brilliant book on this that came out last year called Don't Talk About Politics, by a researcher called Sarah Stein-Librano, which I really recommend. And she, you know, she sets out, I interviewed her in this book, and I just did a bit on this, but she's done a whole book on it, and it's really engaging and really makes that case for it.
Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of the Climate Action Show. Today's episode featured an interview with Anthea Lawson about her book, How Not to Save the World, which will be published in Australia on the 29th of September. And you should be able to pre-order that from independent bookshops in the meantime. If you want to hear more from Anthea, her Substack link is Anthea Lawson, that's AntheaLawson. Substack.com, and I will put more info up on the 3CR website about it.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.